right now on Current State.
As much as I can do everything in my power to stop someone like Larry, I can't stop the next person who rises to take his place.
The woman who first spoke publicly about being assaulted by Larry Nassar tells us what she wants from MSU. A pair of reporters explains why justice for sexual assault may depend on the victim's race. We're on the ground in Puerto Rico.
We didn't have communications during the first couple of weeks, so basically I would go to the communities and ask around.
Hear from the native son who put his career on hold to help his homeland.
And I can't imagine what it would have been like to watch baseball being played in canoes.
Parades on the Red Cedar, U2 playing at MSU. Learn how to get the ultimate history guide for the Spartan in your life. And meet the man from Hazlitt becoming a fun force on YouTube. Current State on WKAR is coming up right after the news. From the WKAR studios at Michigan State University, this is Current State. Hello and welcome. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We start with calls for Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon to step down. Michigan Speaker of the House Tom Leonard, the Lansing State Journal, and others have called for her ouster. They say she and MSU let down the victims of former sports doctor Larry Nassar, who pleaded guilty to multiple counts of criminal sexual conduct. But the Board of Trustees are firmly standing behind Simon, and they made that clear in their monthly meeting, which protesters attended last Friday. WKAR's Scott Pohl was there.
MSU is facing civil lawsuits and growing criticism because of the Nassar assaults on athletes in his care while on campus. But the MSU trustees are firmly behind President Simon. Trustee Brian Masalem chairs the board's compensation committee, which recommended that, in lieu of a pay raise of $150,000, the money will be instead sent to the Roy and Luana Simon Scholarship Fund for first-generation college students. Board President Brian Breslin read a statement from the board in response to the Nassar controversy.
To express our concern for and commitment to these brave young women, we are establishing a $10 million fund for counseling and mental health services and instructed the MSU leadership team to accomplish this with the utmost urgency.
For her part, Simon expressed sorrow to victims for the pain of their abuse. Speakers during public comment then took aim at MSU's response to the Nassar story. Lisa Lorenz is the mother of survivor Kaylee Lorenz.
She has nightmares of his assaults, and I often cry myself to sleep, knowing that you could have stopped him.
President Simon ended the meeting by committing to look into MSU's procedures and says she welcomes the voices of Nassar's victims. Scott Pohl, WKAR News.
A warning now, the next 5.5 minutes may contain material that is not suitable for some of our younger listeners. The first woman to publicly say she was sexually abused by Larry Nassar was Rachel Denhollander. Her comments helped break the case wide open nationally, leading to investigations and eventually prison time for Nassar. Denhollander talked last week with current sports host Al Martin. Here's a portion of their conversation.
Oh, I saw Larry when I was 15, and it was in 2000, which we know now is after four other women had already warned Michigan State University of what Larry was doing. And so what he was doing with me and with these other women was he would tell us that he needed to vaginally penetrate with his fingers to adjust the muscles internally. When he began to manipulate me, my presumption was there's no way that Larry could be doing this without someone having said something. And if someone said something, surely Michigan State would have taken those concerns seriously. So whatever he's doing, this must be legitimate medical treatment. And that was my thought process as a 15-year-old. I trusted that those in authority would have listened had any concerns been raised. And so I allowed Larry to continue with what I presumed was medical treatment.
Rachel, I know your mother was in the room during some of these visits. I was reading through the testimony that you had earlier this year. Did she notice anything unusual at the time?
You know, she really didn't, because Larry was very skilled at what he did. He would position himself in between the parents and the patient, and then he would use either towels or clothing to conceal where his hands were. And that was part of also the dynamic that would keep young girls quiet, myself included, as we presumed our parents did know, and we did not realize that our parents couldn't see what was happening. And again, I presumed that Larry would not be allowed to be in intimate contact he would not be allowed to be doing these procedures on a regular basis because it was something he clearly did regularly.
When was the moment that you knew this was not acceptable treatment and that something seriously wrong was taking place here? When did it hit you?
You know, that was something I really came to very gradually. There was one particular thing Larry did at one of the last visits that I saw that I knew crossed the line. But for the vast majority of what he did, it took me almost 16 years of medical research to be able to really come to the conclusion that nothing he had done was legitimate medical treatment, because I presumed that he was operating at least under the color of having been trained to do these legitimate procedures, because there can be legitimate medical procedures that include internal access to muscles. My presumption was that Larry was operating under the color of having had that training. So when I came forward and I spoke publicly about what he was doing, and his response was that he does not do internal work, and his colleague's response was that he does not do internal work and that he has no training for it, that really flipped my world upside down. Because I presumed, again, that Larry would never have been allowed in contact, intimate contact with young girls, if he was not properly trained to do internal pelvic floor procedures. And that if someone had raised concerns about him penetrating girls as young as 11 and 12 years old, that those concerns would have been handled properly so that he would have never had access to everyone else. And so it took years of research to be able to come to that conclusion, because I presumed he was trained and I presumed that he was being properly supervised.
Rachel, living with the trauma, as time went on, how much did this troubling experience weigh on you? And when did you start really opening up to people about what happened?
Well, you know, I mean, the ramifications of sexual assault are life-changing. They are for everyone. And I think that's something that as a society, we really don't grasp fully. But you know, a big part of the damage that comes from sexual assault really is how assault victims are responded to when they speak publicly. And so I was very careful who I spoke to. And I did not speak publicly about it until I came forward to the Indy Star. And even when I did, the responses that I received, particularly from people at MSU, were incredibly damaging. And so, you know, you really can't look at the impact of sexual assault and the damage that it does without looking at how the victims are re-victimized when they finally choose to speak publicly. And when they're finally able to make their voices heard. And we really see that re-victimization happening at a very significant level with how the victims have been treated when they have come forward and spoken about what took place at MSU.
Rachel Denhollander, the first woman to publicly accuse former MSU and USA Gymnastics team Dr. Larry Nassar of sexual assault. Rachel, how do you cope with that pain and seeing what's about to happen with Larry Nassar? Again, he was, you know, sentenced to 60 years in prison on the child pornography charges. Does this serve as any kind of win for you? And how do you cope with the pain that you have endured throughout this entire time?
You know, seeing Larry brought to justice is certainly something that brings closure and a sense of relief, because I know this man won't be harming anyone anymore. It is very incomplete, I feel like, however, because as much as I can do everything in my power to stop someone like Larry, I can't stop the next person who rises to take his place if these dynamics at these organizations don't change. And right now I am not seeing any hope that they are changing, because we're 17 months into this and they are still refusing to listen to our concerns and refusing to listen and acknowledge the problems that happen in their organizations. And so that is part of the way that I deal with the pain, is that you use it in a positive way to push forward, to make change, to be able to look at what happened to you and say, it can be done better the next time. Little girls can be protected better the next time, and to not give up on speaking that message of how it needs to be done differently.
You were listening to Rachel Denhollander, the first woman to publicly accuse ex-MSU and ex-USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar of sexual assault. She appeared on Current Sports with Al Martin on Friday afternoon. MSU President Luana K. Simon issued a statement on Friday. It reads in part, "As I have in the past, I want to express my respect and appreciation for the MSU police who worked tirelessly to bring Nassar to justice. To the brave young women who came forward about Nassar, you have my deepest thanks, respect, and sympathy. I am truly sorry for the abuse you suffered, the pain it caused, and the pain it still causes. I am sorry a physician who called himself a Spartan so utterly betrayed your trust and everything this university stands for. Time now to get an update on what's happening at the Capitol, and our intrepid Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth is here. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So it looks like the state lawmakers have wrapped up the year pretty much. So we'll start with talking about pension changes, which became really controversial at the end.
Yeah, this was something that a lot of lawmakers were really focused on getting done. And initially, they had a really just aggressive package that would let the state, you know, in some cases step in these local governments that have underfunded or unfunded retirement funds. And eventually the governor came in, there was a big late night session, and they really scaled it all back. So now local governments are going to have, you know, some oversight from the Department of Treasury. They're going to have to show that their retirement funds are, that there's money in those banks, but it is not nearly as aggressive as they had initially planned. But as a lot of lawmakers are saying, you know, this is, it's some movement, it's something, and they were able to get it done.
You know, I remember there were like tons of firefighters and law enforcement folks who even rallied at the Capitol. I mean, they were watching this very closely and at some point provided a lot of pushback at some point.
Absolutely. And, you know, that is one of the reasons why you got that really scaled back package, because they were really concerned that with the steps that were in the original bill, that was going to start taking away and that their retirements were going to get scaled back. And so at the end of the day, I mean, police and fire, those unions have a huge influence in our state government. And you got the package that we had, and it's, you know, it's your classic compromise. Everybody's okay, but nobody's super happy.
Let's talk about opioid bills, because, of course, there's an epidemic going on here in Michigan and across the country.
There are a few bills that are actually quite a few bills that are headed to the governor's desk for his signature. And these bills are really focused on limiting the amount of opioids out there in the market. So you're seeing things like increased tracking of these prescriptions. There's one bill that requires a so-called bona fide relationship between the prescriber and the patient. And that's to prevent this so-called doctor shopping, where people are just kind of hopping from doctor to doctor, just trying to get these prescriptions filled. And so those are the bills that are going to be headed to the governor's desk, and hopefully will start to curb this opioid epidemic that we've been going through.
Also, there's been a lot made about the lack of skilled trades workers coming up. In fact, I understand the average age of tradespeople are in their 50s, so we're concerned that young people are not going into those professions. So what are lawmakers doing to get more skilled trade workers?
There was a package of bills that actually got passed earlier this week before the end of the year. And these are bills that the governor really support. He has really been focused on increasing the number of people in the skilled trades in the state. And these are really focused on that. You know, they're focused on getting kids interested in skilled trades, you know, allowing them to do different things in high school as opposed to just focusing on that college track. They want kids to know that it's okay to, you know, be a welder, be a carpenter, and do all these things. And not only is it okay, it's probably going to be really profitable for you. One lawmaker I talked to who is in big support of these bills, he said, you know, there's a business that has a job and it was for IT, you know, something you would go to college for, and it paid, you know, let's say $35,000 and had these great health benefits. And they had hundreds of people apply for that job. That same company had a welder, which makes twice as much, has the same great health benefits, and only two people applied. So there's really this shortage of, you know, people who are willing, ready, and able to fill these roles that are out there. And they're hoping that these that this bill package will fill that gap and help that out.
Thank you, Shayna. And she's going to come back in our next half hour to talk about the state starting to accept applications for medical marijuana licenses. So for now, thank you, Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're on the ground in Puerto Rico, weeks after Hurricane Maria. Hear what it's like to treat storm survivors from a temporary clinic. And later, find out why some say the best way to kill invasive plants here in Michigan is to let them do the job themselves. You're listening to Current State here on WKAR. Yeah.
Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico. Brinquense por 35 la isla completa.
Thank you for listening to Current State right here on WKER. We always appreciate your support as well. I'm Reginald Hardwick, your host for Current State and Digital News Director at WKAR. Wednesday, December 20th, will mark 3 months since Hurricane Maria ravaged Puerto Rico. New estimates are that hundreds of people died and thousands were left homeless. Michigan State University and WKAR interns Sergio Martinez Patron grew up in Puerto Rico. This past Thanksgiving was his first time to return to see his hometown and the rest of the island. He took along recording equipment to capture one of the stories of how the U.S. territory is faring with damaged homes, unreliable power, and moments of uncertainty. Here's what he found.
Living in Puerto Rico most of my life, I'm used to the nightly greeting of the little frogs called coquis. But this time, stepping off the plane is different. The hum of generators and the smell of gas and diesel fill the hot, thick air. The next day, I am walking to the Bantiox Clinic in Levittown, 25 minutes west of San Juan in the north coast of the island. Two Army National Guardsmen are posted on the entrance. The clinic opened in a former Head Start school site near the center of Levittown 9 days after Hurricane Maria. It is run by volunteers, many of them students from the University of Puerto Rico.
I'm the leader of the medical interventions in the community, so what I do almost every day is basically house calls.
That's Cristian Rodriguez, a volunteer doctor in his 30s who does house calls. He has short, dark hair with some gray on it. He's wearing a black scrubs with jeans, and he's about to start work.
After the hurricane, there was a lot of elderly patients and bedridden patients who weren't getting their medical attention. So we would go house to house and find these patients. We didn't have communications during the first couple of weeks, so basically I would go to the communities and ask around.
Dr. Rodriguez recently finished his degree in medicine in another island. He grew up in Puerto Rico, and he came back to help after the storm.
I alone found approximately 5 patients who had suffered strokes during the hurricane, and they hadn't had any lab work or anything, no CT scans, because they didn't even know they had a stroke. So it was a little intense, and it was kind of hard to think that was happening in my hometown, that people were actually having strokes in home and they weren't being seen by a doctor.
And for Dr. Rodriguez, coming back to help was never a question.
What keeps me going? I don't know, man. This is home, you know. You try to take care of your home. And when you see your community in need, I mean, and half of the medical personnel have left, we don't even know how many doctors we lost.
This clinic has seen more than 4,000 patients since its opening. Inside, there are cubicles made out of gurneys piled on top of each other. Volunteer Dr. Azim Ilahi from North Carolina talks to a patient through a student translator.
So tell me what's been going on.
She tells him that her sons have been sick and her chronic condition is causing her a lot of pain. In another cubicle is Dr. Ingrid Carter, a volunteer doctor from Florida. She sees Ana Hilda, a short woman in her 70s. She is a diabetic who comes to the clinic after developing lacerations on her right foot. Her house survived, but most of her neighbors are struggling to take out more than 3 feet of mud accumulated inside their houses after the water from a nearby river made its way in.
She had sores on her
foot. Dr. Carter has been to different countries and have assisted in crisis as a traveling physician, but this clinic feels different for her.
To be honest, I'm amazed at the resources this clinic has available. I've never seen such availability of medications for patients, and we can give a full complement and course of antibiotics and treatment. So excited, and hopefully that more people will come and keep us very busy for the rest of the week, because that's why we're here.
The hurricane season in Puerto Rico ended on November 30, but there's still uncertainty in the island. Streets get flooded every time it rains, the breeze still clogs the sewers, and people have to walk in knee-deep water. It's a struggle to drive a car from one side of the street to another. But the rain cannot keep doctors like Christian Rodriguez from this clinic.
It's in moments like these when all those things I learned back in school, maybe in high school, come back to light, and you realize this is a moment where you have to take care of your community because no one else is going to do it.
In Levittown, Puerto Rico, I am Sergio Martinez Beltran for WKAR News.
You can see pictures from Sergio's trip on WKAR.org. And we say buena suerte, or good luck, to Sergio, who graduated from MSU this weekend. He's going to go a long way in the journalism business. Invasive plants and animals are an expensive problem in the United States and right here in Michigan. Nationwide, federal agencies spent more than $100 million last year to control them. But a recent study on the garlic mustard plant shows that it might be better to leave some invasives alone. Our partners at Great Lakes Today help us cover the growth of problem plants and animals. Rebecca Thiel reports.
Paul Vugtveen, a chef in Michigan, is standing over a sizzling frying pan. Sometimes he'll add some raw garlic mustard, which he describes as a garlicky, oniony herb.
And you can just throw it in with, at the end of a saute, just to kind of brighten it up.
Vugtveen uses garlic mustard much like Europeans did when they brought it to the United States in the 1800s. It was also used to treat ulcers and gangrene. But garlic mustard has a dark side, too. It spread all over the Northeast and Great Lakes region, wiping out native species in its path. Garlic mustard has this secret weapon, a chemical called sinigrin. It leaches into the soil, killing a beneficial fungus that other plants rely on to get nutrients. But now, scientists have spotted a weakness. After years of domination, garlic mustard starts giving up the fight.
This weapon, if you will, it's not useful if you're competing with other members of your own species.
That's Richard Lankow, who teaches plant pathology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He co-authored a recent study on garlic mustard in the journal Functional Ecology. Garlic mustard is a forest plant with heart-like leaves and clusters of white flowers. It can grow up to about 4 feet tall and is often the first green plant you'll see in the spring. Lankow's team found that over the span of decades, large expanses of garlic mustard stopped producing as much sinigrin, which might allow native plants to move back in. So, if a big bad invasive species like garlic mustard can stop being so invasive, should we still try to control it? British ecologist Ken Thompson says, maybe not.
Over time, what happens is the species evolves, the species with which it is competing evolve, and this apparent superiority slowly begins to decline.
Thompson wrote a book called Where Do Camels Belong? The Story and Science of Invasive Species. Over Skype, he said the most worrisome invasive species is us. After all, we're the ones changing the environment.
I mean, how likely would it be, after all the changes we've made to the world, that the native species that used to live in all those very changed habitats are now the best species adapted to live there?
Thompson says often methods used to control invasive species, like spraying herbicides, do more damage than the species itself. Lankow says one lesson is that all attacks from invasive species shouldn't be treated the same.
There are places where the invasion is sort of hot and heavy, where it's probably worth investing a lot of resources in, and there are other places where it's cooled off a little bit, and maybe our resources are better used in other ways.
Out here at the Kalamazoo Nature Center, science is put to the test. Walking along a wooded trail, invasive species manager Ryan Kozatek says volunteers pull out garlic mustard to give native plants room to grow. Last year, they pulled 10,000 pounds. That's the weight of two rhinos. Kozatek says he isn't ready to change his strategy for dealing with garlic mustard just yet. But it's worth talking about.
So at this point, it's kind of a nice to know and something to consider moving forward.
For Great Lakes Today, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Did Did you know MSU students went on strike in 1902? Or once a storm dumped 20 inches of snow on campus? Or U2 and the Rolling Stones played Spartan Stadium? I talked with MSU Archives Director Cynthia Gearing about a new book that may be the ultimate journey back in time for Spartans.
The staff at the archives, including a lot of our fabulous student assistants, had helped us pull together some of our favorite stories. So we have 39 stories in this first volume that chronicles campus and traditions here at MSU. What we did with this book is we took some of our favorite blog posts and exhibits and stories that we've collected over the past decade and pulled it together in one volume, which is just 39 vignettes with over 100 photographs, just to kind of wet the whistle, I guess. There's a lot of different stories and there's variety. It's eclectic, but it's fun.
So let's go through the book. You know, what are some of the highlights that you've kind of pulled out for us?
Well, some of the ones that I think are really fascinating are chronicles of the class rivalry that used to happen in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The sophomores and the freshmen would really have a serious rivalry going on. The freshmen men needed to wear beanies to designate the fact that they were freshmen. If sophomores saw them without their beanie, they were thrown into the Red Cedar. And then after several months of harassment, basically, they had some kind of a rivalry event where they did tug-of-wars and strongman contests to figure out who ruled the campus, the freshmen or the sophomores. And we have some fabulous stories from that time period, as well as these posters that the students created calling out either the sophomores or the freshmen. They're pretty violent. They're in color. And I think they're really exciting and very unique, something that, of course, would not happen nowadays on campus.
So, and for people, just to give you a hint of what you'll see, either if you get the book or you see a picture on our website, WKAR.org, it does involve a sword with a little bit of blood dripping off. It is drawn on there. It's not a picture, but it is amazing that that went on about 100 years ago on this campus.
Yes. Administration really wrestled with it from year to year, tried to make it more of a phys ed type of event, you know, have safety perimeters. Students got hurt. It was a real problem. And whenever administration would crack down on it, the students would find an alternate location to have the class rivalry.
What is another example you wanted to bring us?
Well, we did quite a bit about student life in the 19th and 20th century, and there's everything from women's clubs with the first women students on campus, the women's program. Then we have Greek life and a nice chapter on the African-American presence at MSU, and it has a lot of different stories about some really wonderful folks that went to MSU, majored in various things, went on to do great things, all from students to Dr. Wharton, Dr. Clifton Wharton, the first African-American president of Michigan State and research, major research university in the 1970s. So that's a really interesting section. And the pictures, I think, really make it. There's the stories and then these fabulous pictures that help illustrate what it was like at that time.
What is one picture that just made you laugh out loud?
There's in the 40s, the Red Cedar flooded repeatedly, and there were baseball competitions that happened, and the whole fields were flooded. So the students in that time period made up something called canoe ball, and they played baseball in canoes. And the photos are really fun, and I can't imagine what it would have been like to watch baseball being played in canoes on the river, over the banks of the river. It's really fun, and whenever I see those kind of pictures, I think of how ingenious our students are here at Michigan State still.
Really? I know. That's incredible that they came up with that.
I know. And there used to be floats for homecoming on the Red Cedar River. We have some photographs from that and some description of what the floats were like. Again, really ingenious ideas, a lot of creativity from our students.
So this is volume one. Are you working on other volumes?
We are taking a break right now, but we plan in the new year to start on volume two, which will include buildings and people. I'm not exactly sure what the full title will be, but the topics are there. And of course, we have to do athletics in more detail.
What was it like for you to kind of oversee this project and take a journey back in time?
Well, I will have to tell you that my staff oversaw the project. They coordinated it. They came up with the idea themselves. And I did not actually read a draft of the book until it was nearly finished and edited. And I really have to give kudos to the archivists who love their job. We think we have the best job on campus. It's a really fun place to work. And all the history that we get to be with every day is exciting. When I read it cover to cover, I was fascinated. I had seen almost all of these stories before in our exhibits or in our blogs, but in a book form all together like this, it was really exciting. In some parts, I got chills about how great Michigan State is and this great legacy that we have, our heritage.
You've been listening to Cynthia Gehring, director of MSU Archives, and we've been talking about the new book, Tales from the Archives, Volume 1, and it's available now. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Reginald, for having me.
We're joined now by Tarana Burke, the creator of the Me Too movement, and Alyssa Milano, one of the actresses who helped that hashtag go viral.
The Me Too movement is a force that swept through America in 2017, but some say it doesn't apply to African-American women from Michigan.
People are not able to see Black women and girls often as victims in the same way that we're willing to see white women and girls as victims.
I'll talk to the writers of an eye-opening investigation next. Plus, important insight if you or someone you know is investing in a medical marijuana business in 2018.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tyler Oakley, and today is a very special day. It is the...
And move over, Tyler Oakley. There's another MSU YouTube sensation with a rising fan base. More Current State on WKAR is coming up.
Second chance you'll never get. And yeah, I know how bad it must hurt to see me like this, but it gets worse.
Wait a minute, my payback is matching. Baby, I'm a baddie, stop playing with the savage. Can't have this, oh.
And it'd be nice of me to take it easy on ya, but no.
Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. By now, you've probably heard of the Me Too movement, women coming forward to talk and seek justice after being sexually harassed or sexually assaulted. But a new article in The Bridge magazine says that the seeking justice part does not apply to African-American women in Michigan. It focuses on the case of 31-year-old Shawana Hall of Kalamazoo, who was brutally attacked in 2008. Despite physical evidence, emotional testimony, a jury found her alleged attacker not guilty. Writers for The Bridge, Kadita Williams and Danielle McGuire, wanted to know why this is not unusual when it comes to Black female rape cases in Michigan. They both join me by phone now. First, Kadita, what prompted you to look into this issue?
One thing to keep in mind is that Danielle and I are both historians, and we study issues of racial justice. And so we are very familiar with the histories of sexual violence and racial violence and the ways that African-American women and girls are often underserved by the judicial process. So we've been paying attention to the sexual assault kits and the cases that prosecutors have been bringing forward. And this was a case where we had the opportunity to learn a little bit more about the survivor and understand the process. And what we wanted to do was to share that with a larger audience.
It was striking to me to see the headline, Me Too, Not for Black Women in Michigan. Danielle, give us an overview of the article and how you arrived at that point.
You know, we were following this trial in Kalamazoo
of Calvin Ray Kelly, who was on trial for the kidnapping and rape of Shawana Hall. And as we were, you know, monitoring it, we noticed that he had been accused of rape in at least 10 other states by other women, and that he had not been charged anywhere. And so we were really expecting that in this case, there would be a guilty verdict for him. You know, with this overwhelming amount of DNA evidence and corroborating reports and a willing, you know, survivor who was willing to testify, we figured it was a slam dunk. But it wasn't. And when Kadada and I were talking about it, we realized that, you know, part of the problem, based on our own knowledge of history, was that, you know, people are not able to see Black women and girls often as victims in the same way that we're willing to see white women and girls as victims. And so we started to talk about this and said, you know, we really ought to do a story about this because there's a lot more here. For one thing, we both knew about the discovery of more than 10,000 untested rape kits in Detroit. And because Detroit is a predominantly African-American city, we realized that a number of those kits were probably from Black women and girls. And the fact that they were left on a shelf in a warehouse untested meant that their lives didn't matter. Their stories didn't matter. What happened to them didn't matter enough for people to take them seriously. And that was a problem. And that's a problem that's rooted in our history. But we also knew that there were a number of women, primarily, around Detroit and in the state, who were working really hard to not only get those untested kits to the lab and to prosecute the assailants that they found from them, but that there were women around the state who were fighting for the most vulnerable women in our community. And we wanted to tell their story as well.
We're talking with Kadida Williams and Danielle McGuire, who wrote the article for The Bridge magazine, explaining why Me Too doesn't apply to African-American women in Michigan, particularly in the justice system when it comes to sexual assault cases. Danielle, what was a moment in the process of investigating the story that kind of gave you pause or maybe outraged?
There were a number of those moments, I think. One was reading the report by Professor Rebecca Campbell at Michigan State University that looked at why so many rape kits were not tested. And the reasons behind that was a victim, a history of victim shaming, a culture of victim shaming, even within the police department, so that they would get a report from a girl or a woman and not take it seriously and blame the victim. You know, well, what was she doing? What was she wearing? Why did she get in the car with him? Those kinds of questions that put all the onus for assault and violence on the woman, and a system of shortcutting within the police department that gave rise to the untested kits, you know, where officers would really put the onus on the victim to prosecute their own case.
Kadida, do you think Black women who read this article will be both surprised and not surprised at all?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. They will be both, like, shocked, you know, like, hopeful that there is a possibility of justice, shocked and hurt by a verdict like this. But again, I think that one of the issues here is it's not just even what the jury did. It was Kelly's strategic predation, right?
Yeah.
You know, on marginalized women and how he played to the jurors' views on marginalized African-American women. And I think that what people in the African-American community can do potentially is see the reality of this. And, you know, I think looking at the full details of the case and its aftermath, it's, you know, it's just heartbreaking, you know, because Kelly is right now, you know, or since the verdict, he's been giving interviews essentially calling Ms. Hall and other women liars.
Well, we've been talking with Kadida Williams and Danielle McGuire, who co-authored the article for The Bridge magazine, Raped and Left on the Road. She said, hashtag Me Too. Jurors said, no, not you. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Thanks for having us. There's an outcast in everybody's life, and I am her. There's a shadow in everybody's front door, and I am her. I am her. There's a dark cloud in everybody's sunlight, and I am her. I am her. Oh, no, I am her.
This year, WKAR News has closely covered the issue of medical marijuana in Michigan. On Friday, the state began accepting applications from provisioning centers, growers, processors, secure transports, and labs that want to operate in Michigan. And our Capitol correspondent, Shana Roth, is back here. And you were there waiting for lines of people to start getting their applications. What was the scene like?
Not as you would expect. Not as I expected. I really have to give credit to the State Department. They were essentially ready for the opening time slot of Star Wars with this. They had signs everywhere pointing people where to go. They had those velvet ropes, you know, everything kind of lined up so that way mazes of people could fit on the courtyard. And they were all very organized, ready to go. They had extra security and nobody came. At least as of about 9 o'clock in the morning when I was over there. I had gotten there at about 7 a.m. thinking, well, maybe there'll be people early expecting a line, and nobody was there. I came back at 8 when the doors opened, and again, you know, nobody was there. I did speak to the Director Brisbow, who is sort of in charge of all of these medical marijuana licensure activities, Andrew Brisbow, and he explained that, you know, this is something that people can do online, and they were him and a few other employees who were there all night ready to make sure that the online application works properly. You know, they were monitoring the system all night, and at 12:01 a.m., people were already starting to look at the applications. I think only about one or two people actually submitted the application, but they did have, you know, a handful of people looking through the application, figuring it out. You know, this is a thing where it's not like other states where they have a cap on these licenses. They are giving out as many licenses as people qualify for. So I think there's probably not that rush to get things done as there might be in other states because there's not a limited quantity of them.
You covered the Lara hearings all over as they were working through these rules processed. I mean, it's not like there hasn't been a lot of attention on this.
Yeah, and there has absolutely been just a ton of attention on this issue. It's been covered by a lot of the media. And, you know, this morning there were actually more media people there than there were applicants. You know, they started to trickle in later on in the day around 9:45. They'd had a few people come in. This is something that, you know, the state has really been, you know, letting people know all of the many steps that they're taking. You know, a rule rolls out and they let people know. And quite frankly, a lot of people report on it, myself included. So this is something that has been going on for a little over a year or about a year. And, you know, between the meetings and the regulations coming out and, you know, different news about this, that coming out, this is something that if you're following it, you have gotten news on it, you know, almost every month. This is something that people were prepared for. And maybe, you know, a lot of people in the state just decided I'm going to do this online, or, you know, I'm going to take a look at the application. I'm going to think about it. And quite frankly, it's going to be pricey to get one of these applications. So it's possible that some people just don't have the funds ready to apply for these licenses.
Thank you, Shana, for updating us on that.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now let's talk a little bit more about the regulations. WKAR Morning Edition host Brooke Allen talked with Andrew Brisbow. He is the director of the Bureau of Medical Marijuana Regulation, which is within the Michigan Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, or LARA.
We have to conduct a thorough background investigation of all the applicants, which is going to take a bit of time, and then we'll start issuing the licenses. The Medical Marijuana Licensing Board has the final say in the issuance of licenses, so everything that we review will be packaged up and sent to them, and they'll review those at a public meeting before issuing any licenses. We're going to analyze all the principles of any applicant to determine their eligibility. We're also going to make sure that the facility meets all the standards as promulgated in the emergency rules as well as covered in the statute. And we're going to make sure before we issue a license to any facility, they have to have municipal authorization through an ordinance before they can operate as well.
Explain that.
So municipalities under the Act have to opt in to allow these facilities to operate within their boundaries. They have zoning authority. They can set zoning standards. They can set any qualifications related to the operation of facilities that don't conflict with the state law. Now, the state is the authorizing body that will give the licenses to these facilities, but will only do that if the municipality has authorized their operation. And they can restrict the types of facilities that operate. They don't have to allow all five, and they can set a cap on the number of facilities that operate within their municipality as well.
So if a municipality did not opt in, then no marijuana would be allowed in that area, correct?
Correct. We would not issue a license to a facility unless there was an authorizing ordinance. That's right.
Okay, so now let's talk about the cost of all of this.
Sure. So there are a couple costs authorized under the Act. There's an application fee at the time of application that we will collect. That's $6,000. That is meant to offset the cost of the background investigation that we'll be conducting. There's also a regulatory assessment, which is paid just before the issuance of the license. We haven't set that fee yet. We want to get a good sense of how many applicants we have and how many licenses we'll issue so that we set that fee appropriately to offset the costs that are statutorily authorized to be covered by that regulatory assessment. And provisioning centers will also have to collect a 3% excise tax on the sales that are made to patients and to caregivers through their facility. In addition to all of that, so those are all the state level fees, if you will, municipalities can also charge up to $5,000 per year for a facility that's operating within their boundaries as well.
So what if somebody applies for an application and they're turned down? Do they get their money back?
They do not. Those fees are non-refundable.
Is it possible for the state to say yes and a municipality to say no?
So we wouldn't issue a license unless they were authorized by the municipality through an ordinance. So that's going to be part of our validation process before we issue a license. But we did split the process up at the state level. So an applicant can apply and conduct have the background check conducted and be pre-qualified, we call it, so that should they not be able to operate in the municipality where they were hoping to locate, they can use that pre-qualification to apply for a license for a facility in another location. Or for operators who want to operate multiple facilities, they go through the background check process once and then submit multiple license applications as a secondary process.
So they don't have to keep paying the fee?
Correct.
Okay. So how many applications do you think you're going to get?
That is a tough thing to estimate. We hear different things from different people. We're prepared to have a pretty high volume of applications. We've set the process up so that applicants can apply any way they choose. We will accept applications online, in person, or through the mail. So we want to make the process as open and easy to follow as possible.
So how long do you think this process is going to take for an applicant to know that they're approved? Is that the right word?
Correct. We would approve and issue a license at the end. It's probably going to take a few months for us to start issuing licenses. So we'll start taking them in December, and we hope to be issuing licenses by the end of March or early April.
We've been speaking with Andrew Brisbo. He is the director of the Bureau of Medical Marijuana Regulation within LARA. And a reminder, you can go to WKAR.org and look for the Marijuana in Michigan section. On the right-hand side of the page, we have all of our stories on this topic right there for you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tyler Oakley, and today is a very special day. It is the 10th year.
Earlier this year, I had the pleasure of speaking with YouTube sensation and MSU alum Tyler Oakley. And there's another MSU grad with a million subscribers on YouTube, with a truly global appeal. MSU intern Skylar Ashley, who is also graduating this weekend, introduces us to this viral video sensation.
You've heard of Tyler Oakley, MSU's homecoming grand marshal and YouTube star. But there's another MSU-linked YouTuber gaining more than a million fans around the globe. Sungwon Cho, known online as ProZD, is making quite a name for himself. Cho has amassed a large digital following from his apartment in Hazlitt. 1 million subscribers click on his videos featuring his fast-paced humor, like his skit, A Villain Who Unintentionally Always Does Helpful Things.
The city is doomed, Commander Fistfight. I've poisoned the water supply.
Actually, because you poisoned the water supply, we discovered that the city's pipe infrastructure is really severely outdated. So thank you for bringing our attention to that. Millions of people could have gotten really sick over the next few years. Secondly, because you snuck past the security system so easily, we found out that funds specifically for that security system were being embezzled by government officials, so we've busted a major fraud ring. And finally, the pathogen you unleashed does give people mild diarrhea, but we found it also is a great source of vitamin C.
Okay, whatever, take this!
You fixed my shoulder.
God!
Cho earned his popularity on Vine, Twitter's now-defunct video service, where users were limited to just 7 seconds of content.
On Vine, it was really just an impulse. And at the time, I was, like, intimidated by it, because I was like, there's no way I can do something in 6 to 7 seconds. How are these people doing this? But after seeing a couple, it made me go, I want to try it. So I dabbled in it. One of the first Vines got a big reaction, and I went, okay, I think I can do something with this.
While best known for streaming viral videos, Cho's main passion is voice acting. He's been featured in video games for the PlayStation 4 and the Steam Network.
I've done some video games. One that recently came out is called A Hat in Time, which is on Steam now and will be released on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One later this year.
Cho has dedicated fans. They love to watch him do something as plain as, say, eat a bowl of ramen noodles.
Whatever, if that's what they like to watch, I'm totally fine with it. I like food a lot, so food will come up every now and then in some of my videos. I feel like my YouTube channel has just been this weird sort of zen garden I'm cultivating of all my interests.
Cho graduated from MSU in 2012 with a degree in media arts and technology. It didn't prepare him for YouTube stardom, but gave him the tools he needed to get started.
Besides the editing side of it, I did get a lot of practice with acting because I got to do like a radio play as one of my projects where I voiced all the characters, and I would do voice acting for other people's projects and that sort of thing. So I got some practice here, which I enjoyed.
Cho will continue to upload on YouTube, but is expanding to the streaming service Twitch. You can find his videos by searching ProZD and catch his voice acting later this year in A Hat in Time, which will be available on PlayStation 4 and Steam. For WKAR, I'm Skylar Ashley.
And that's it for this weekend's edition of Current State. WKAR station manager is Peter Worf. Susie Elkins is director of broadcasting and general manager of WKAR Public Media. And I'm Reginald Hardwick, WKAR digital news director. Have a great weekend.
Got a boy back home in Michigan, and it tastes like Jack when I'm kissing him, so I told him that I never